We made this.
To Vampire Videos, where we are exploring 100 years of vampires on film and television, one bite at a time. I'm Hugh McStay, and joining me to excavate the graveyard of vampire cinema, as always, is my co-host Dan Owen. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Hugh. I'm back again.
Can't keep a good Dan down.
We can't, no. And it's always a nice sunny day, isn't it, when we do these? So it's just really, I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, I think we joke every other week about the fact that I'm from Glasgow and, you know, we don't get a lot of sun, but it seems because I've started making that joke on a regular basis that God himself is out to spite me, because as I sit here, I'm very close to just bursting into flames like a vampire in the sun. It's not good.
Yeah, it's really, really hot. But I'm excited to talk about this film. So this should be really, really exciting. We've got a really good guest as well. So what we're going to talk about today is the horror comedy Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but not the one you're thinking about. It's the Fran Rubel-Kazooie 1992 film version, starring Christy Swanson as the famous teenage heroine as she takes on Rutger Hauer's master vampire Lothos.
I just met this girl named Buffy.
I'm Pike.
Pike isn't a name, it's a fish.
I liked her, even though she seemed kind of flaky. But as it turns out...
You have been chosen, Buffy.
To do what?
To stop the vampires.
Does Elvis talk to you?
And things started getting weird around here.
Are we having a nightmare?
You threw a knife at my head.
And you caught it.
She was the one person I could really count on.
Kill him a lot.
Hi.
Hi. What are you doing here?
What am I doing here? I'm saving your butt.
That is a bad guy. Can we go, please?
The Slayer is unmasked. Let's finish it.
I think this relationship has potential.
Hi. How's it going?
You're obviously having a bad hair day.
If she can just get rid of those other guys in her life.
Stab him in the heart!
Christy Swanson.
I am so sure.
Donald Sutherland. Paul Rubens. With Rutger Hauer and Luke Perry.
Buffy, you're not like other girls.
I do mention that there used to be a movie before the TV show, and a lot of people are not aware of that, so it's be interesting.
Yeah, I think so. It was an interesting one for me as well, because I'd seen it many years ago, but you know, it'd been so long since I'd revisited it. So yeah, I'm interested to see what you think. But obviously not just you, because as we are, as every week, we are joined by a guest on the podcast. So let's just open the podcast kit this week and we'll see who's inside. That thing gets heavier every week, Dan. It's screenwriter Dara Carvel, creator of ITV drama The Bay. Hello, Dara. How are you?
Hi, guys. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
How was the podcast skit? That was our VIP version that we sent out.
It was actually very, very comfy. Yeah, it was snuggly.
Got aircon in there, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, we need it today, yeah.
Thanks so much for giving us some of your time, Dara. What we'll do, we'll just have a little chat about your history with the vampire genre, if you don't mind, what your vampire diary. How did you first become aware of vampires and horror film? What were some of your earliest experiences with them?
Well, I remember very vividly my first encounter, I suppose, with vampires. And strangely enough, it was in the movie Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman. Not Abbott and Costello Meet Dracula or anything straightforward like that, but the Wolfman movie, which includes Bela Lugosi in what I think was his last performance as, you know, as Dracula himself. And there was a kind of spate of movies shown on, horror movies really, I suppose, shown on telly in the 70s. I grew up through the 70s and 80s. You probably hear from my voice in Northern Ireland. I'm from Armagh. And I was just thinking about this sort of in preparation for the podcast. There was a real theme of horror for children at that time. So I was sort of surrounded by, you know, vampires and ghosts and ghouls, you know, whether it was on Sesame Street, you know, the Count, or whether it was in comics. So we used to get a comic called Shiver and Shake that was sort of comedy horror with sort of Frankenstein's type creatures and ghosts and vampires and demons. But very, very early on in my memory, it must have been like 1974 or something, something like that. So I would have been five. I remember watching with my brothers Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman. And Lon Chaney Jr. is in there, of course, as the werewolf. But it was Bela Lugosi as Dracula that really, really terrified me, scared the bejesus out of me. But I loved it at the same time. That was the crucial thing. And around that period was when I also became, I'm a massive Doctor Who fan, and I've got very early memories of, you know, that sort of 1973, 74 period, John Pertwee. And I remember that combination of being absolutely terrified and absolutely loving it. And it was the same thing with something like Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman. There was probably a Scooby-Doo with vampires around then as well. I mean, we're just surrounded by ghosts and demons and vampires in that.
Do you know the title of that Scooby-Doo episode at all? I can add that to our list.
Oh, I'm just speculating that there must have been. There must have been. So yeah, so that was my first. And then I suppose growing up and going through school and then going on to college and stuff, I definitely retained an interest in horror and fantasy, but particularly the kind of gothic. So vampires was definitely part of that. And I read, you know, the classics of the genre. It sort of helped that some of the great sort of founding documents of vampire literature are written by Irish writers, because I was studying Irish literature and sort of hoping to become an Irish writer. You know, I was sort of trying to absorb that tradition. And so, you know, something like Sheridan Le Fanu's Camilla, an early, you know, kind of 19th century vampire story. But obviously then Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is an absolute masterpiece while at the same time being sort of terrible in lots of ways. I loved that. And I was very interested in the kind of gothic underpinnings of the genre, and interested in ideas about sort of, you know, the kind of the presence of the past and buried secrets and, you know, blood being spilt and all of that, and how that played out in terms of thinking about Irish literature and sort of Anglo-Irish relations. So I was intrigued by all of that. And then when I did manage to kind of start to make a career for myself as a writer, I grabbed every opportunity to work in that kind of gothic arena, I suppose. So I was really lucky. I wrote an adaptation of, well, it was a kind of an abridgment really of Stoker's Dracula for Radio 4 that Michael Fassbender was in. And then my first TV credit was on Toby Whithouse's brilliant fantasy drama Being Human, which you'll remember was a sort of flat share with three characters, one a vampire, one a ghost, and one a werewolf. And I came in on series 5, where the vampire character was Hal, played by Damien Maloney. So it's been with me, you know, from the get-go, you know, from watching Abbott and Costello as a child with my brothers through to what I do professionally. It's sort of, I'm steeped in vampire lore. And then also as a fan, and, you know, this will bring us to Buffy, you know, I'm a huge fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the series. So I'm very interested about the movie, which is interestingly the same thing and a completely other thing.
Yeah, interesting caveat that, yeah, the series. Maybe not the movie.
You've definitely come to the right place, I think, if your history is anything go by about your love of vampires. It's something Dan and I can certainly appreciate quite a bit. So yeah, that does bring us on to the film in question, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the 1992 Fran Rubel-Kazee film, which, yeah, as I said, I don't want to bury the lead and give my thoughts away too harshly on it at the moment, but it's a very interesting piece of work. Joss Whedon, obviously, who would go on to become the executive producer and creator of the TV series, he sold the rights to the film to Dolly Parton's production company, Sandor Productions, which kind of got the ball rolling on it. But it's such a fascinating behind the scenes story, which I'm quite keen to get to speak to you about, Dan. As a screenwriter, you must have so many thoughts on this film and what maybe happened to the screenplay as it's gone along. But before we get to that, could you just give us some of your initial thoughts of the film, obviously avoiding too many spoils at home, but just your general overview of it?
Well, I'm sort of fascinated by this film. I have a strange relationship with it because, as I say, I was a huge fan of the Buffy TV series pretty much from when it started, but I hadn't seen the movie. So I came to the movie as a fan of the TV show, and by the time I watched the film for the first time, there'd maybe been 3 or 4 seasons of Buffy on television. So I kind of knew it really well. It was an uncanny kind of experience, literally, to go and see this other version of this story world that I knew so well. And that was so brilliantly done on television. I mean, obviously there are kind of issues with the show here and there, but by and large, I think it's a very, very successful version of that. that story. It's a very successful sort of iteration. Mm-hmm. So then to see something else that isn't a hugely successful version. I mean, I think we can put our cards on the table here and say that the TV series is a creative, critical and commercial success. The movie is a failure critically and creatively. Commercially, I think it did okay, but it really is something of a failure. I think there's lots of interesting and positive things to say about it too, so I'm not going to just be damning it. But what sort of interests me really is trying to understand the nature of its failing, given that it is, you know, it's based on the same material, it's the same writer, it shares much of the same, you know, set of ideas and the same sensibility. So how come one version works brilliantly and one version doesn't quite work? And maybe that's what we can get into.
The juxtaposition between this and the TV series is quite striking. Dan, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I'm a bit of a latecomer to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, to be honest, because back in the 90s when it started, I just wasn't interested in it for some reason. Even though I'm a vampire fan, I always had it in my head that it wasn't really, this is going to sound really bad, but I thought it was like a girls TV show, weirdly enough. I was young and stupid, but I just thought...
I've changed.
It's just something about it. I just thought, oh, it's not really for me. For a long time, I didn't watch it. And then I first watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the not too recent past, really, like 2010 or something. And I got the DVD box set and went through it. And I think it's a different experience when you watch it, you know, very many years after it had sort of reached its peak and no one's really talking about it anymore and it's long over. So I was able to watch it with different eyes, maybe. And obviously, a few things have dated in that show, etc. So it's an interesting experience, anyway, to go back and watch like a much championed TV series. And I definitely enjoyed it. And there's some real classic episodes in there, I think everyone can agree. But I'd actually had seen the film. So for a long time, the film was like the only thing I had seen. So I did see the film back in the 90s, probably mid-90s at some point. And I remember not too much about it. I remember a few of the jokes that still lingered in my head. But yeah, it didn't really leave a big impression. But going back to this, it was a bit of an eye-opener because this is not a good film at all. And definitely in comparison to the TV series, it's like awful compared to that, really. But it's interesting, like Dara was saying, because it's kind of just exactly the same premise. It's just a very different tone, isn't it? This is a lot lighter and goofier, maybe, than the TV series, which was a bit more... It was definitely fun, obviously, the TV show, but it was definitely darker, wasn't it? Maybe. And obviously the performances and things, very different. I think this misses having more of an ensemble feel like the TV series had with Willow and Giles and all of that. And here you just really have Buffy and the Watcher character, Donald Sutherland. And she has some friends, but they're not really like part of a Scooby gang, as they called it, are they? So it's a bit of a different approach. So that's my main thoughts. It's not a good film, but it's very interesting to compare with the show that came later.
No, I think that's fair. So, I mean, yeah, much like that, our cards on the table from the outset. I mean, Buffy was one of my sort of like formative TV shows growing up, and it influenced a lot of my tastes when it comes to like the kind of films and TV show that I like in comedy. So I'd always kind of pushed back against revisiting this film because, you know, I love the series so much, and you know, you're just like, oh, God, I don't want something that's going to maybe affect how much I love the TV series. So I kind of put it off. But I kind of went into this with as open a mind as it was possible to go in with. And I'll be honest, I was surprised at how much fun I had watching it, even though I fully accept and acknowledge that it is objectively bad. It's not a good film. I sat down last night, actually, to watch it with my 15-year-old daughter, and she was a huge fan of the TV series. You know, a geeky dad that I am, I made sure that she saw Buffy growing up, so she watched that. So yeah, she was keen to see it as well, but she lasted about 25 minutes and decided, Dad, I'm just going to go to my bedroom and do something. I was like, yeah, okay, honey, that's fair. But yeah, I was struck with the similarities in tone to something like Clueless. As I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, is that maybe what it's going for? Is that what it's aping? But of course, it actually came out, like, I think maybe 3-4 years before Clueless. So in some ways, you know, it's maybe influenced some other films that came afterwards, but I found quite interesting. And, you know, I think I agree, it's got a lot of the same sort of beats as the TV series, but it seems to lack the sort of the depth of the TV series, which, as you said, Dan, is a lot of fun at times. But I think the thing that had people coming back to the TV series over and over is the sort of the melodrama of it, you know, and like some of the performances are genuinely terrific in the TV series as well. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, overall, I wouldn't say that I didn't enjoy watching it, because I did, but I suspect that it might not be one I revisit for another maybe 20 years or so, unless there's maybe a retrospective podcast coming off on it. So yeah, it was quite interesting. So Dara, just go back to what you were saying there. I mean, I agree. I don't think it's the kind of film that, you know, that we should be ripping apart, because it, you know, it does some things well and some things not so well. Let's start with some of the negatives. What do you think? What were some of the big issues for you? And again, especially coming at it from a screenwriter's point of view, I find that fascinating. What sort of things that you were picking up that were causing your problems?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I found most interesting, because I first watched this film, oh, it was probably 20 years ago. You know, I was writing then, but I wasn't working in film and television. So coming back to it as a screenwriter was fascinating. I think the lessons that you can take away from it are to do really with, well, tone was one of the things you mentioned earlier, Dan. That's absolutely right. And I think that's part of a wider thing, which is about a shared vision of what story you're telling, what film you're making. And the more I watched this and then, you know, watched sort of DVD extras and sort of read around it and so on, the clearer it became that the key creative problem is that there wasn't a shared vision of what the film was. And that goes right across the board. It's you know, from, you know, individual performances, lots of people feel like they're in different films, to the approach of the director, to what Joss Whedon was intending with his original script. It sort of feels like everybody is on different pages. I've watched the most recent Blu-ray, which has a few little, not very much. I'm sort of disappointed in the way recently what we used to relish as all of these lovely DVD extras have sort of disappeared. And now you just get, you know, the odd little trailer. There's a tiny, what they call a featurette, a sort of little behind the scenes 5-minute piece on the Blu-ray that I watched. And it's quite interesting because, I mean, I guess it was the sort of electronic press kit that went out with the movie at the time, and they interview various people involved in it. But even from that, you get a sense that they're all talking about different projects. Donald Sutherland, we'll come back to Donald Sutherland, but he says, literally in this kind of promotion for the film, he says, you know, something along the lines of, I was too embarrassed to tell anyone I was in a film called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He's sitting there in costume on the set saying this as part of the promotional drive. And then it cuts to, I think it's Rutger Hauer who says, oh, I think it's wonderful. I think it's perfect title. And there's also a very brief interview with the director, Fran Kazooie. And she says, I've written this down because I thought it was very interesting. I don't think of Buffy as a vampire movie, but vampirism is the context of this comedy. Okay, so she's very, very explicit. This is not a vampire movie. This is not a horror movie. This is a comedy. And, you know, the vampire horror bits are just a context for the comedy. Now, there's no question that Joss Whedon's an incredibly funny writer. And one of the things that still works about this movie, you know, there are still maybe half a dozen laugh out loud lines in here. There are some very funny moments, but he's not primarily a comedy writer. What he writes is drama that has, you know, that can be funny when that's appropriate, and, you know, or when it adds something to be funny, but he's not writing just full on comedy. Clearly the director thought she was making a comedy. I don't think Joss Whedon thought he was making a comedy. And then some of the performances, I mean, Donald Sutherland is just clearly bored. He's just not interested in what he's doing. He sees it as beneath him. You sort of really wonder, why is he doing this? You know, this is a great actor who's done extraordinary work. Why is he doing this film? He sort of clearly sees it with contempt. And by all accounts, he was very difficult to work with on this movie, and part of the reason why Joss Whedon walked. Paul Reuben, Pee Wee Herman, does what is essentially a kind of panto performance as Rutger Hauer's kind of henchman. I mean, his death when he's staked. I mean, sorry, that is a bit spoilery. But there is a moment, and then they reprise it in the end credits. So they're obviously very pleased with this. And it's clearly him just messing about and improvising and sending the material up in a in a way that feels like, you know, it feels like it's in a sketch show for a studio audience or something. It's just totally tonally wrong. And then you get some of the other actors. I actually think Kirsty Swanson's very good in this. I think she's not as amazing as Sarah Michelle Gellar, of course, with, you know, very few actors are. You know, that's one of the great performances in television history, I would say. I think that's up there with, you know, the best, Peter Falk as Columbo or whatever you care to name. But she's good. It feels like she sort of does get the tone of it. And Luke Perry, who's a bit of a heartthrob, obviously, at the time, he seems to understand the kind of movie he's in. In fact, in that little featurette, there's a quote from him. He says, it's a comedy, it's a love story, and it's scary. So at least he's aware that there is an element here that's meant to be like a kind of scary movie. But it's this inconsistency across the board where everybody's sort of making a different film or acting in a different film. It goes through to stuff like costume. It goes through to sets. We get those flashbacks to some sort of medieval world where Kirstie Swanson and Donald Sutherland are wearing terrible costumes, like something out of Rent-A-Ghost, and there's awful wigs. Nothing feels real. There's a real lack of commitment to reality in this film. Now, obviously, you know, it's not reality because it's a vampire movie, it's a comedy, and even if you set aside the vampire element, it's very heightened. But at the same time, the only way to make those things work is to play them as real. And I think that the lack of a shared vision and then the lack of, you know, the resulting lack of commitment to any kind of grounding in emotional reality, those are the things that fatally scupper this movie, I think. And those are exactly the things that the TV series gets right. It's very emotionally grounded. It's very real, even though it's also incredibly heightened and full of melodrama and madness. The essential metaphor of, you know, high school and growing up and battling demons as a metaphor for what it's like to grow up and try and get your way through school, that just works brilliantly in the series. It's glimpsed occasionally in the movie, but it's because there isn't a sort of shared vision of what it is they're doing, it never really takes off.
I think you've covered quite a lot of the film's key issues are there. Yeah, no, I agree with you. One of my big hates about it watching it last night was that you could see Whedon's script kind of peeking out every now and again from the rest of the film, and it kind of reminded you of like, oh, it could have been better actually. You know, there may be, I'd like to see the original script without any of the edits to see what it looked like before Cousine kind of decided to change all that. But then I think the film also suffers from not having much of, it doesn't really feel like it's directed quite often, you know, it just feels like things happening. It's a really odd, it's oddly composed and put together where, as you said, sometimes it feels like different films budging up against each other and none of them are overly successful in what they're doing. And like, you know, the idea that Donald Sutherland was given essentially carte blanche to just do whatever he wanted is remarkable, because I know that Fran Rubel, because he had said that she, you know, they largely allowed Sutherland to improvise a lot and just, you know, do his own variations on the dialogue. And I think that's obviously what would eventually send Whedon, you know, spiraling and sending him off the set in a rage, because they weren't following the kind of the blueprint that he had laid down. Now, obviously, the elephant in the room here is Joss Whedon himself, who's proven to be a bit of a problematic individual. But if we're simply talking about the work that he's done and the script that he prepared for this, he's clearly gone on. He went on to show that blueprint was dynamite. It was absolute gold dust. Yeah. And he was able to, you know, to create this amazing universe that would run for, what, 7 seasons and a spin-off out of that, just so that core idea kind of spun out and leaping to different things. What do you make of that, Dan? I mean, what do you think about the film, the big issues?
Yeah, I mean, Joss Whedon, he actually was a staff writer, wasn't he, on Roseanne around this time. Mm-hmm. So he did have like a, you know, he's more known for the comedy, I suppose, at that moment in time. And this was maybe his attempt to break out and do something a bit different, obviously still in the comedy realm. But this must have really scared him away, because as you've put together in your dossier, Hugh, about this movie, he was like an advisor and he went on set and apparently just hated Donald Sutherland and the fact that he was being allowed to improvise and just what they were doing with his scripts, taking out a lot of the jokes and messing things around. So he kind of just left the set and went on to do other things. I think he was a script doctor, wasn't he, for Speed and Waterworld and
Toy Story as well. That's the big one.
Co-wrote that, and Alien Resurrection, wasn't it? So he kind of scared him away, didn't it, from making his own kind of movies for a little while.
The Alien Resurrection one, I always find that interesting story, because like, he fought hard to have his name removed from that script because he was so unhappy with what the director had done with it. I mean, again, like I said, I think there are many, many issues with Joss Whedon as a man, as a person, but as a writer, I think he's incredibly talented. And there's a story that goes around that when he was brought on to Marvel to work on the Avengers movie, and he said he was given the script by Kevin Feige, the Marvel sort of studios head honcho, and after he read it, he said, well, I'm just looking for some notes on it so you can beef it up. And his response was, well, you need to start by throwing it in the bin and hiring someone else to write it. You know, he's got such an absurd amount of confidence in himself, which I suppose it obviously stood him good stead to get him where he went. But yeah, it's hard to talk about Whedon in general, I think, at the moment without kind of having knowledge of some of the truly appalling behaviours that he's done.
I was thinking about that earlier when I was saying, you know, I've got an odd relationship with this movie. It was partly because of that thing of coming to it as a fan of the TV series, but also revisiting it now since the revelations, the sort of Me Too revelations about Joss Whedon's behaviour, his sort of predatory nature and his bullying. I'm watching it through a very very different prism. And I haven't actually revisited the TV series since learning more about who Joss Whedon is. And I don't know if I can bring myself to go back into that world right now, which is, I find, sad. But there's something galling about the way that he presented himself as a kind of feminist crusader and vocal spokeswoman for strong female characters and all of that, and was actually behaving appallingly. All of that said, and none of it excused, he is a brilliant writer, or he was a brilliant writer. Someone said you need to have sort of bifocal lenses as a writer, because you need to be, at the same time, you need to have an overview of the whole structure of a story. So you need to be able to take the long view, you know, not only across an individual episode, but across a whole season and maybe a whole series, you know, seven seasons. But you also need to have an eye to the close-up detail of individual moments, individual lines, individual words. Some writers are good at one, and some writers are really good at the other. I mean, there are some writers who are just brilliant story strategists, and they can plan and create these fantastic plots that really work like clockwork, but maybe their individual scenes, their writing of dialogue doesn't entirely sparkle. Then there are writers whose structure can be maybe a bit flabby, and, you know, the stories might sometimes, you know, have lulls and meander a bit, but their line-by-line writing is beautiful, and they write cracking dialogue. I mean, for me, Joss Whedon, like Russell T. Davis, has both. You know, he's both a fantastic storyteller, a structural writer, mm-hmm. and an incredible close-up line-by-line writer. Some of that you can still see in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. I mean, a lot of it is obscured, and we know that there were changes made. Apparently, the Donald Sutherland character, Merrick, the Watcher, in the original script, he apparently kills himself in order to save Buffy from the Rutger Hauer lead vampire. He sacrifices himself. So they cut that. They got rid of that. And then at the end of the movie, in the original screenplay, she burns down the school gym with all vampires inside, which is famously referenced in the TV show, but doesn't actually happen in the movie, because they decided not to go there. They changed it. And quite a lot of what doesn't work script-wise in the film, you can feel is because of those changes that are being made. But then you get those moments of just like beautiful little diamonds of dialogue. It's interesting what you were saying about Clueless, because you're quite right. The Buffy movie came out in 92, Clueless came out in 95. So it was ahead of the game in terms of those kind of smart, wisecracking, high school, valley speak sort of comedies. I suppose you'd had Bill and Ted before this, which was maybe the first introduction to, you know, most of the world of that kind of California speak.
Oh, I was thinking of Wayne's World as well.
Wayne's World. So it's part of that, and, you know, and it feels like it was a relatively early part of that sassy one-liner wisecracking approach to these kinds of stories. And some of that, I think, still works really well. I mean, there are lines like, does the word duh mean nothing to you? There were lines that kind of jumped out at me and made me chuckle, kill him a lot. That feels very Joss Whedon, and that sort of, that has survived. But I mean, I feel like I'm a ex-Joss Whedon fan, or a sort of recovering Joss Whedon fan. I still find his work fascinating, and I suppose to some degree I find him fascinating, but I also find him appalling.
I would love to read the original screenplay, actually, because I'm wondering if it was like a case of Joss Whedon being a great writer, as you've said. Did he turn in a fantastic script, and then he just had an inexperienced director mangle it, and nobody was interested in the project because the title was silly and they didn't really buy into it, and so it just fell apart? Or was he kind of still quite inexperienced back then, so was his script not that great, really? I'd love to kind of read it and see what happened, because I mean the director only did one movie before this, something called Tokyo Pop. And then since this movie came out, she'd done nothing since this. But there's an interesting kind of connection to Buffy that lingers with her. But
I mean, the way Joss Whedon tells the story, or has always told the story, is very much the former. It's like he wrote a fantastic script and it was ruined by everybody else. But he was a relatively young writer at the time. You know, know, maybe it wasn't the greatest script ever. But the thing he's very clear on is that the movie never matched up to his idea of who Buffy was and how these stories would work. And he's been very consistent about that. Uh-huh. So I think that is clear. And it does, I mean, it goes back to that thing about lack of shared vision. You know, he was probably not in a position to direct it himself then. Obviously, he's gone on to direct a lot of his own work. But if he'd been perhaps taken more seriously by the production team, or perhaps if there was a more simpatico director, if not necessarily a more experienced one, then that might have helped.
I think just talking about, like, you know, the what might have been or what might have happened. I mean, I think the fact as well that the production was limited to only 5 weeks to accommodate Luke Perry's 90210 schedule didn't help. You know, and there is a feeling of that, of just like, you know, zipping through. I mean, the fact the film clocks in at less than an hour and a half, and I actually think its pacing is maybe one of its strengths, because it does zip along really quickly, you know, and I think that's why I had so much fun with it, because it doesn't outstay its welcome if it's just going to be less than an hour and a half and kind of get in and do what it's going to do. But yeah, you do wonder if maybe it's things like that worked against it. And I think it had a budget of around $7 million, so I mean, not a huge budget, but quite, you know, for the time, not too bad either.
It's interesting what you say there about the time pressures, the 5 week thing, because what I was wondering earlier when I was thinking about it again, there's a few moments in the movie where the editing is so incompetent that it's quite startling. It's sort of the sort of thing you see in, you know, old B movies or old telly from, you know, the 50s or 60s or something, where there's just like, it looks like shots have been dropped and things just haven't worked and they've just put it out anyway. And there's that kind of weird moment where there's meant to be some sort of gag with a hot dog with a wiener, and clearly we're meant to see Buffy do something like cut it in half with a knife or something, but we just don't get that shot. It just doesn't happen, and everybody reacts as if something's happened, but we haven't seen it. And then there's another moment where there's a car chase and suddenly Pee-wee Herman vampire Paul Rubens is suddenly on the windscreen of Luke Perry's, you know, truck or whatever it is, and he sort of just appears there. We don't see any, you know, impact or anything. He's just like clinging on there and drive, and as they drive along. And there's kind of moments like that I think probably are to do with only having 5 weeks. And because what I was wondering actually, well, is that a budget thing? Just did they just not have the budget to do the stunts or whatever, or what, you know, did they run out of money or something? But I think time is probably more the issue.
It's funny you mentioned the hot dog scene, because I thought, because I watched this on Disney Plus, and I thought they'd maybe censored something because it's more of a, you know, kids kind of platform in a sense, you know, being Disney, and it's on the, I think it's on the main kind of Disney feed, isn't it? It's not in the star category or anything. So I thought there was something cut out, but you saw it on the Blu-ray. So if it's not making sense on your Blu-ray, then yeah, just bad editing, I suppose.
I think that's just the way it is. It's really peculiar.
What made me laugh as well was when you first, well, I don't know if it's when you first see him, but when Donald Sutherland is the Watcher, there's a scene where he appears and the vampires just kind of grab somebody, but it happens, the way it's staged is like, it's literally happened in front of him. You should have seen that, but it's kind of staged as if like he didn't see that happen.
Yeah,
but he's literally about a foot away, isn't he?
I noticed that as well. You almost hear a Scooby-Doo like zoinks, you know, as the guy gets dragged away down the side of the cliff.
Yeah, really odd.
and I mean, while we're... God, I said I wasn't going to put the boot in, and there was lots of things to enjoy.
We will get some positives eventually.
But similarly, the fight sort of choreography is so lame, and, you know, they just sort of lumber around. It's all very slow. You know, there's no sense of pace and crackle and energy and excitement in those kind of fights, which is, you know, the whole point, surely, of a scene where the Slayer does battle with vampires. You would think that should be exciting, but it's really not. And even the choreography, not just the choreography of the fights, but the choreography of the cheerleading opening section.
It really
just looks like everybody's just sort of making it up as they go along. It's got this strangely amateurish quality, which, you know, if it was a decision and you committed to it, could be quite charming, but you sort of feel it isn't. It's just, that's what they did on the day. and that goes for the fights as well. They've got a slightly cobbled together quality to them, and they just kind of lack sort of punch and sort of excitement that you'd want.
I think they hired one good gymnast to stand in for Buffy, who could do some martial arts, and she had the one good sequence when she's kind of training and she does a few flips here and there, and that's about it.
Yes, yeah, and that bit, that's become almost iconic, that sequence. the sort of training montage type sequence. They do that in the show as well. It's kind of one of the things that survives through to the other iteration.
It was missing some inspirational 80s power chords though, which was my only disappointment to the training montage.
There's a bit of that in there too. There's a bit of, it sort of looks a bit like bad rock videos from the time, or adverts for, I don't know, shampoo or something.
Yeah, given the way a lot of the vampires are dressed as well, I mean, I would love to have a conversation with the person who decided that that's how they were going to dress the vampires. I mean, obviously Paul Reubens looks like an aging rock star, you know, who's hit hard times, and then you've got the, you know, he's got his underlings who look like, I don't know, like homoerotic chauffeurs with they're wearing the most bizarre outfits. And then, you know, when Rutger Hauer shows up, he's dressed like Dracula, and you just think, where's the uniformity here, folks? What was the decision on this?
Who gave him a blonde mustache? And that was a mistake.
He at least seems to be enjoying himself, Rutger Hauer. Compared to Donald Sutherland sort of phoning it in and being clearly bored and contemptuous, at least there's a sense that Rutger Hauer is enjoying himself. But yeah, you know, it goes back to that thing about a lack of shared vision. There's no sense that at any point really a conversation was had about making the vampires scary or threatening. The vampires themselves are comedy characters. I mean, and this plays out most clearly in the Paul Reubens performance. There's never any real sense of threat. So even though there is quite a high body count, you know, there are lots of teenagers being murdered in this movie, there's no sense of threat because baddies are goofy comedy characters who also look ridiculous. And in the, again, you know, it may be unfair to compare it with the TV show, but the TV show, while it certainly had plenty of, you know, tongue-in-cheek and camp, and it does sort of send up the genre to some degree, there's always a sense of reality to it. So a character in the show like the Master, who's the kind of big bad of series, you know, looks like Nosferatu, is properly frightening. I mean, like my kids, we rewatched Buffy when my kids were small, and they found that character genuinely frightening. Nobody would find this movie scary.
No, absolutely not. In the interest of me saying some positive things about this film, I will say that I think the cast in general, with obviously Donald Sutherland as a big asterisk next to his name, I think the cast in general are all pretty good. Kirstie Swanson makes a really good Buffy, which is something, again, because I love Sarah Michelle Gellar's performance so much, is not something at all I imagined I would feel after watching the film, but she really nails it, I think. And the way she sort of vacillates between the sort of vacuous airhead in this sort of sweet, neglected teenage girl, you know, before we get to the combat scenes, I think she's terrific. I mean, in fact, she was so good that I was able to forget for an hour and a half that she's become one of those crazy pro-Trump right-wingers like Dean Cain. You know, they're in their own little camp now in Hollywood. But genuinely, I think the cast in general, as you said, Rutger Hauer, he seems like he's having a lot of fun, although he's not remotely scary, and he's dressed in a way that is, you know, not at all like any of the other vampires you see in the film. You know, at least he gives a fun performance that you can kind of enjoy in the moment, and it fits in with the weird tone of the film as well. I think Luke Perry is perfectly fine with what he's given to do, to be honest, you know. And it was probably quite a big departure at the time for a star of kind of his magnitude, because I suppose this would have been around the time of the height of the 90210 fame, and it was probably quite a departure for someone like that to be playing second fiddle to a female lead. And I think, to his credit, he even kind of gamely plays the sort of damsel in distress to Buffy's hero in the final act of the film,
where
she's allowed to take central stage, which again goes back to that thing where I think the script has its gender politics and its heart in the right place when it comes to gender politics, whilst it doesn't always land. You know, obviously the creator himself doesn't, but the script certainly has that there. And you know, I actually really like Luke Perry in this, although again I think that the biggest cheer for me in the film is when, you know, the scene in the bathroom where he finally shaves off that soul patch. Thank God it's finally gone.
That was a rare air punch moment in this movie. But it's interesting, you're absolutely right. Luke Perry, I think, is very good and clearly gets it. And again, going back to that featurette, he says, there's a little interview with him. In fact, it's probably the longest interview is with him. He was clearly the biggest star at the time. Mm-hmm. And he does say, Pike is the damsel in distress in the movie. So we did the big role reversal thing and Swanson's the hero. And that, I mean, you know, when we're talking about the things that work in this movie, that essential idea is so strong. The idea of the blonde cheerleader, who is usually the victim in this type of movie, becoming the hero is such a clear and strong idea that that still works. And I totally agree as well. I think Kirstie Swanson, for all her contemporary politics, is very good in this movie. She really does convince you. She's got really good comic timing. And I think that works really well. There's a thing that's been sort of percolating in my brain as we've been chatting, again, just about going to the heart of what doesn't work here. And I'm reminded, as I mentioned earlier, I was a Doctor Who fan, and I'm reminded of something that Douglas Adams said when he was working on Doctor Who, was script editor of Doctor Who in the later 70s, around the same time as Hitchhiker. And he bemoaned the fact that too often when actors and crew get hold of a script that has jokes in it, they see that as an opportunity to deliver a sort of tongue-in-cheek performance or production. They don't take it seriously. They start to send it up, and you get, there's a quote from him somewhere where he talks about you get the silly voices, the funny voices, and the silly costumes. And it feels like that's really fundamentally what has gone wrong here. People haven't taken the material seriously. They've sort of latched on to the elements that are funny and have just gone, oh, right, so the whole thing's meant to be funny. Instead of going, well, no, actually, there's a core of emotional truth to the drama here. And also, the threat needs to be genuinely threatening if any of this is going to work. So it's that sort of send-up quality that I think really does fatally damage it.
I think for me, the best scene is just when Luke Perry and Kirstie Swanson are just together. It's when their characters, I think they go to Buffy's house after a bit of action, and they just talk to each other as like normal teenage people. And there's no kind of jokes or anything so much. It's just them two kind of connecting, isn't it, as we go forward for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's the only scene that kind of like I engaged with, because there wasn't any silly jokes or anything, and they were taking it seriously. Mm. Like you say, that was the only moment really, I think, in the whole movie where it was taken seriously.
It's that scene. It's funny, I've got that written down in my notes as well, Dan, to pick out that scene, because it's one of the few scenes in the film that almost feels like it could have been lifted from the TV series, you know, because the TV series was never afraid at times to really take itself quite seriously and drop all the gags, you know, for something that was important. Mm. And again, it's like, I guess it's one of the great lost scripts, I suppose, isn't it? I would love to read this original version, because it'd just be interesting to see where the highlights were, what the emphasis was in the original script as opposed to what we ended up getting, because there are snippets, there are bits around the place that work quite well, but yeah, there's just not enough to kind of to hang a coherent film on, unfortunately.
Yeah, I haven't been able to find the original script. You know, you kind of think you can delve into the corners of the internet and you'll find any script from, you know, of anything ever. I'm sure it is out there, but I know it was developed into there's a comic book version called Origin that sort of combines elements of the movie with the elements of the series. So it apparently builds on Joss Whedon's original script, but it connects it in more closely to the kind of Sunnydale and Sarah Michelle Gellar version of the character that we know. So it might be worth reading that. It's interesting just what you're saying there, Hugh, about, I mean, I don't want to get off topic here, but about the seriousness at times of the TV series. And the first thing that came to my mind was the episode The Body. Mm-hmm. You know, again, danger of spoilers, but I'm just going to say it. It's the episode where...
I think you're fine after 20 odd years. We'll be all right.
It's the episode where Buffy's mother dies. And it's genuinely one of the most powerful dramatic representations of the reality of grief that I have ever seen. It's absolutely beautiful and brilliant. And you kind of think the sensibility that the guy who wrote and directed that was the guy who wrote that movie. And you can see there's a massive mismatch there between the kind of seriousness intent and the seriousness of intent and the kind of, you know, he knew that this story, the story of this young woman growing up and, you know, battling demons through high school, had the capacity to genuinely go to very powerful emotional places. I kind of think he must have known that from the get-go. And so it must have been crushing the experience of what happened with the movie. Certainly as a screenwriter myself, the stories of, you know, not just the stories of Donald Sutherland misbehaving on set or improvising or, you know, chucking bits of the script out. I mean, that's horrific. But also the idea of, you know, turning up on set to find that this thing you've put your heart and soul into, nobody else is taking seriously. People are just messing about with it and sending it up and acting as if it's silly. Not even just silly, but trash. That must have been awful.
I know Whedon had spoken quite a few times about that people push back when he had come to make the show because of his insistence that it was going to remain titled Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because they felt that they would lose a lot of the audience just through people who just think, well, that sounds ridiculous, I'm not going to watch that. And it is all the more interesting when you, as you said, that as the series went on and it touched on such like really serious and big subjects as it went along. And I think I'm in agreement with you. The Body feels like it might be Joss Whedon's kind of masterpiece, you know, in terms of like a tight 43 minutes that is just devastating from start to finish. And similarly, I've never seen anything that captures the sort of the moments after, you know, the death of a loved one so honestly and so, you know, without any airs or graces. It just, and for a show, again, for an episode like that appearing in a show that is titled Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it's quite interesting, the sort of the tonal shift that's required, I think, from the viewer to be there.
It's one of the great titles though, isn't it? Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Absolutely.
I mean, everyone remembers that title. I remember when the TV show was coming out, you know, the title alone just sells it, you know. I actually used to know somebody who was called Buffy.
Wow, really?
For a long time I thought it was a made up name, but yeah, I actually knew somebody. I worked with somebody whose sister was called Buffy. I thought, oh, I'll bet she was born around the time of the TV show, but she wasn't. She was born in like the 80s. So there is a real Buffy out there.
Here's the moment that I confess to you, Dan, that one of my children is named after a character in this show. My youngest daughter is Anya McStay.
Oh, wow.
So that's where that name comes from. Yeah, my partner and I bonded over that when we first met like 20 odd years ago. And when my second daughter came around, it felt like the right name for her, because she very much is a demon.
Why not Lothos?
Well, you know, we're a bit too late for any more kids, but if any of them pop up, you know, we'll maybe go down the road of Lothos.
There's that thing about the tonal shifts you're talking about there, where a show called Buffy the Vampire Slayer can also tell a story like The Body. That's one of the brilliant things about Joss Whedon. I mentioned Russell T. Davis earlier. I would say he's another master of the ability to shift from something very, very light to something very, very dark, or vice versa, for all of those different tones to connect and feel organically part of the same whole, which again is something that doesn't quite work here. What you were saying earlier, Hugh, that, you know, it feels like lots of different movies edited clumsily together, or sellotape together. Mm-hmm. At his best, it always feels like the different tones are seamlessly integrated as all part of the same thing.
There's two things about the movie that I prefer over the TV series, though. I think I need to put some balance into the conversation. A few more positives. There's only two things. I liked how this version of Buffy, to me, looked and felt like somebody who actually could take out some vampires, because Sarah Michelle Gellar has always, to me, felt a little bit too small and frail looking. I know there's some good action in the series, but with this version of Buffy, I thought, oh, I can really buy that she would be able to kind of, you know, defeat demons quite easily with a kick, like a, you know, or a punch. She had that physicality to her that I quite liked.
No, I get that, because I mean, Kirsty Swanson certainly, yeah, you're right, she looks like she could take down a vampire or two. But I really enjoy the fact that Sarah Michelle Gellar is so sort of titchy, you know, and she's just beating the crap out of all these things. I think that works in its favour.
That was my one attempt anyway.
shooting you down there, Dan, sorry.
Okay, maybe it's a wrong move. The other one was, I quite liked that these vampires were kind of more traditional vampires. They just have fangs and there's some frilly ears at times, but it's generally a traditional view of vampires. Whereas the TV series, they have like that kind of morphing forehead effect, don't they, when they're like demonic. And I've always preferred this movie's version of vampires. So that's another positive for me.
I also like that they don't burst into dust when they're staked as well. There's a sort of like grooviness about that, you know. some of the other films that we've covered, Dan, that's the same sort of thing, you know, when you're so conditioned, I think, from pop culture and, you know, recent vampire films to watch them disappear after they've been staked, to see this sort of bloody corpse remain afterwards. I'll completely level with you, gents. I laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed at Paul Reubens' death scene. I know it's stupid. I know it doesn't make it, I know it's ridiculous, but when there was a callback to that in the closing credits, it set me off again for another couple of minutes. I'm clearly just a child at heart.
And I did enjoy seeing all the before they were famous faces as well. Yes. I think we've got to mention that, because it's quite a few, isn't it? I had no idea that Hilary Swank was in this as an 18-year-old. Obviously she's gone to great things. Mm-hmm. That was very unusual. And there's lots of people in the background, isn't it? There's Ben Affleck.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you spot Ben Affleck? He's in the basketball game. I think he has like one line or something.
And David Arquette, who I thought he started off being quite terrible, but towards the end, when he was in vampire form, I think he was quite fun as that vampire. vampire.
Yeah, I agree.
He was terrible when he first appeared, but he was there. Who else was there? There's quite a few, isn't there?
Ricky Lake is a waitress. Yeah, or she's in the bar, cafeteria, whatever that place is. Again, she has like maybe one line.
I only found out afterwards that Thomas Jane was in it. He apparently was the, you know, there's the very brief scene where Luke Perry's character is working on the car at the garage and there's another guy there with him. Well, that was Thomas Jane. And I've seen pictures of that guy again since, and it looks nothing like Thomas Jane, but people assure me it's him.
I believe that's right. And one that I didn't spot, but I have subsequently heard is in the movie, is actually one of the alumni of the TV show, Seth Green, who played Oz the werewolf in the show, apparently was a vampire in the Buffy movie, but he's only glimpsed. Apparently he had a scene, but the scene was cut, so all you see is like a glimpse of the back of his head, apparently. But he's in there.
Yeah, I'd read that before I saw the film, but I'll be honest, I couldn't find him. I did keep my eyes peeled, but no, I didn't see him.
No, me neither.
And I did enjoy Stephen Root as well as the principal.
Yes.
He was really good. Yeah, handing out detentions. Yeah. Quite a good joke at the end.
The groovy, funky ex-Nam principal. You know, I quite like that as well. Stephen Root's always one of those faces. You know, he's a welcome addition to any cast, I think.
And it's one of the things that Whedon does really well is those kind of smaller parts, like the basketball coach. Mm. He imbues those smaller roles that are usually fairly thankless with some kind of color or texture that just makes them memorable and different.
The only other thing I want to flag up before we kind of move towards the end here is how old were most of those teenagers? I know Grease is kind of like the benchmark for terribly old teenagers, but there was the guy who plays on the basketball team who eventually becomes a vampire. He looked as if he was in his early 40s. it was absolutely absurd. Some of them you can kind of buy it, kind of, you know, you squint a little bit, but yeah, there was a lot of exceedingly old teenagers in that school.
This is the classic issue of making a show about, or a movie that's set in a school, because I'm very conscious of this because we had a certain amount of abuse during the last series of The Bay, which has a kind of school, some of the characters are at school, and we got some criticism for the characters, for the actors looking older than the characters would be. The thing to say about that is, and this goes right back, you know, every movie ever made, if you look back at, you know, Blackboard Jungle in the 50s, or, you know, Please Sir in the 70s, Please Sir, Why Are We Older Than You? They're always in their 30s. And the reason, of course, is really obvious. A, you want really good actors, and that tends to mean people who have, you know, who have experience. And B, the kind of the laws around how long younger actors can shoot for are very strict and can be quite punishing. And so, you know, there are reasons that happened, but yeah, it always takes you out of the reality of the thing. But I mean, you can see even in contemporary show like, you know, Sex Education, everybody's way, way older than they actually be in the world.
Yeah, I think it's consistently a problem. I think you're absolutely right, but it's probably good form not to hire any actors who clearly have had to use some Just for Men in order to pass for a teenager. Just briefly, we'll touch on this because, you know, you don't want to be too morbid, but we did recently lose two of the stars of this film. Luke Perry passed away on the 4th of March 2019, at only 52 years old, from a massive stroke. And it's always sad when someone dies that young, but particularly so because he was having something of like a career resurgence, it felt like. I know he had quite a prominent role in one of the CW shows, Riverdale, as one of the parents on that show. But he'd just obviously been in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well, which you can't, you know, when Tarantino sort of hauls these older actors out of semi-retirement or like obscurity and thrusts them onto the screen, very often leads to like a resurgence for them for a while. And it's so sad because you wonder what he would have gone on to do. And recently I was on a podcast to talk about that very film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I did a lot of reading about Leonardo DiCaprio, and he was saying that Luke Perry was his absolute idol growing up, and, you know, he was so excited to be working with him on set. And it's funny when you think of an actor like that having such an impact on, I mean, I think DiCaprio's arguably one of the modern greats, you know. I mean, you know, we'll be talking about having the same breadth of like Pacino and De Niro in 25, 30 years. So it's just funny to see where some of those inspirations come from.
And who was the other actor who's...
Rutger Hauer died.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Just a couple of months later, on the 19th of July 2019, at the age of 75, after a short illness. And Rutger Hauer is such an iconic screen presence. You know, he's been in everything, every genre, it feels like, as well. He's popped up in as well. He began acting in the late late 60s, continuing his work right up until his death. He notably, I'm maybe stretching it there, he played Count Dracula in 2005's Dracula 3 Legacy, which may or may not be on Dan and I's list at some point, which was the second sequel to Dracula 2000, in which Gerard Butler played the Prince of Darkness. So I don't know, is that an upgrade going from Gerard Butler down to Rutger Hauer over the course of three films? I'm not quite sure.
No, I'm not too sure. You've also forgotten another death, Hugh. Christy Swanson's career. I think it was 1996, thereabouts.
I'll have you know she's currently planning an off-Broadway production with Dean Cain, so I'm not going to have you sully her good name on this podcast.
Okay, fair enough. There has to be a few fans of hers out there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that largely brings us towards the power ranking section. Dan, do you want to take over this and we'll have a look at the abilities and skills of the vampires?
Yep, so we like to go through the power rankings of the vampires in each film that we watch. So we'll start with abilities and skills. So first one off, immortality. Yes, because I think the Lothos mentions he's centuries old and Paul Rubens has lived through the Crusades is one joke, isn't it?
Definitely looks like he's lived through the Crusades.
So that's a definite yes. Strength and speed for the vampires. So did they exhibit anything out of the ordinary?
I'm not sure. It's super. Well, although Paul Rubens does punch through the roof of a van at one point, doesn't he? So I suppose that's kind of strong.
Yeah. Strength of six men or something.
Speed, not so much, I don't think.
No. Yeah, no, I'd agree with that.
They're fairly lumbering.
Yeah, okay. Sexual magnetism or hypnotism. So there is hypnotism, isn't there? Because he kind of hypnotises Buffy, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The Lothos character.
Lothos does, yeah.
Okay. I think we need to be careful talking about sexual magnetism and Paul Rubens in the same sentence, given his criminal record. Let's dance around that a little bit.
This movie came out shortly after he was caught in the cinema fiddling with his steak, I think. That's how I'll describe it. I wondered if that was why they had to remove his arm in this movie.
That does give rise to the great line, another of those great Joss Whedon lines, when she challenges him to clap after he's lost his arm.
Yes, that is terrific, good. Isn't it?
Sexual magnetism. Well, there is like a dream sequence, isn't there, with Lothos?
I think that's quite the connection that he's got to Buffy, I think, is very sort of like, you know, laden with sexual imagery and overtones.
Yeah, that's okay. Shape shifting? Nothing.
Nothing there. No.
Okay, and flight?
They do have, there's one of them that has weird kind of little bat-like ears. The vampire on the basketball court, randomly, again, that sort of the weird, you know, everybody making a different film aspect of this.
Does David Arquette's character as well, Benny, does he not like float outside Luke Perry's window?
Yes, he does, yeah.
Isn't that the joke that they're three stories up and he's knocking on the window like a little Ralphie Glick from Salem's Lot?
Yeah, and you can't tell he's on wires at all, can you?
No, not at all. It's perfect.
Definitely done, yeah. Yeah, that just going back to that guy who had the frilly ears in the basketball scene. It was really odd to me that the coach didn't bat an eyelid. You know, that guy had fangs, he had funny ears, and the coach just doesn't care. They sit down.
So what? I mean, as a sports fan, Dan, they all have their own little things. You know, it's like, oh, he's wearing his lucky ears tonight. That's fine.
That's it. Control over lesser creatures?
No, I don't think we see any of that,
do we? Going on, no. Okay. So on to vulnerabilities and ways to be vanquished. So sunlight, it doesn't happen, does it, in the movie?
We don't see.
But I think the implication is that sunlight's a problem, which is always a funny thing, isn't it? Because Buffy takes place in California, so I always think that's amusing. Yeah, but the town isn't called Sunnydale, is it, either, I noticed.
Well, they're in LA, though, so in the show, the first series of the TV series opens with her moving from LA to Sunnydale, so because she's burned down the school gymnasium.
Okay, yeah, that's it. Okay, sleeping in native soil or cursed earth?
I don't think so.
No, there's no coffins even, is there?
No, I think Lothos sleeps in a coffin, does he not?
Yeah, he does, Holy objects, that's a big no, isn't it? Because there is that moment with the crucifix.
There's some burst into flames,
yeah, it doesn't affect him at all, so that's not a problem. Stake through the heart,
yep, absolutely.
Very much,
that's
so
a big one.
That's the main one for this movie, isn't it? Problems with silver at all?
No, not in this one. No.
Beheadings,
there's a bearming.
I'll have to add that one in.
Bearming.
Yeah, invitation only.
Yes, the bit when David Arquette's outside the window, he's begging to be let in, and then the whole seniors being being allowed into the prom at the end.
Yes. Yep. I was going to say that. That's another one of those sort of Joss Whedonisms that sex, where, you know, the vampires can get into the hall. And she says, well, you did say invite all of the seniors.
No reflection. There is no mirror sequence where you don't see the reflection, but they can't be taken photographs of, can they?
Yeah, there's the photo booth moment, which is quite funny.
When Luke Perry's in the van, is there not a point where he looks in his rear view mirror and he doesn't see anything? And then he turns around and looks like two vampires walking towards the thing. So I think that's maybe there.
Okay, I'm glad you're here, Hugh. I've forgotten about that. That's true. So that's a big yes then. Allergic to garlic?
No. Again, I'm not sure of anything there.
Don't remember that.
No. And my favourite one, crossing running water. Quite an obscure one, but there's no problems as of getting over a river or anything like that in this. Some vampires have a problem with that, I promise you.
Yeah, I do like it when that one pops up. It doesn't pop up often, but it is there.
No, one day it will happen. I'll have a special sound effect ready for that when it happens. So how would you rate these vampires then in terms of their strength, Dara? Give them a fangs out of five rating.
Yeah, I don't want to be a downer on the vampire powers. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the issues with the film is that they're not really scary and threatening and powerful. So I'd say we're kind of in the maybe two out of five.
Wow, that's being kind. No. I'd say one. I think they've got zero kind of fear factor for me.
Fair enough. Yeah, okay, I'll go with that.
I'm going to stick them in at a two as well, but only because whilst the run-of-the-mill vampires are genuinely dreadful, at least Lothos looks like he might be a little bit more imposing. I mean, I know he's more interested in playing the fiddle at Buffy than attacking her at points. Is that on our list, actually, the powers list? Ability with the fiddle? I'm not sure if that's there.
That's Pee-wee Herman again.
I forgot to mention, actually, about the... wasn't there Pike has got hip flask full of holy water, was it? He throws on someone's face, so that's kind of holy objects.
Oh, yeah,
I'm counting
that's
as
right.
that.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We can maybe add that in there.
Yeah, we'll go with that. We'll go with
that's
that.
Everything, yeah. So it's not very powerful vampires in this film.
No, they've let the side down, which is fair. Like the entire film, it's let the side down a little bit.
I suppose the flying thing is one of the more unusual attributes of these vampires. It's not necessarily a classic, is it, that the vampires can fly? Mm. I mean, obviously they can transform into bats and fly, but the actual vampire flying felt slightly unusual.
Yeah. A lot of the films that we've covered, without being specific, but a lot of the films we covered, sometimes they kind of have floating moments, but yeah, in terms of actually flying, they kind of hint that they might be able to do that in a lot of films, but they never really show you anything. So yeah, that is quite an unusual one, yeah. Well, I think largely that brings us towards the end of our conversation on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Dara, do you have any final thoughts that you want to maybe get off your chest while you've got the opportunity to?
No, I just want to say thanks, guys, for the opportunity to sort of delve back into this. I've enjoyed going back to it, and I've really enjoyed chatting with you guys with it. I think it's a really interesting movie, even if it's not a very good movie. And I think it does, certainly for anybody involved in, you know, the creative industries, as they say, I think it does have lessons it can teach us about, you know, just about the importance of a shared vision and the importance of really committing to the material.
Dan, what about yourself? You get any final thoughts on this this delightful film?
Well, I just hope we can bring back the phrase, "What's your sitch?" So that needs to come back, I think.
What's your sitch, bitch?
And, you know, I just want to bring that back. Hopefully the kids of today can watch this on Disney Plus and, you know, grab onto that phrase.
I don't know. If I couldn't get my daughter to sit through 90 minutes of this film, I don't know how many kids to be going to sit and watch it. So similar to what both you gents have said, I kind of, you know, it's not a good film. But I'd be lying if I said I didn't have fun watching it. You know, it's certainly, it's got its moments, got its high points, and it's got its very, 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 very low points.
It's also a bit of a historical piece now, isn't it, being this old? It's quite scary to realise how old it is now. I was 13 when this came out. I know you're a little bit older than me, Dara, but, you know, I think we're all fairly young people in a sense, back in 92. So just watching this brought me back to my kind of school days in a way, because I remember some of the fashions here and that kind of thing. I don't remember quite as much dry ice around the place.
But one of the striking things, I suppose, is that, no, you know, for obvious historical reasons, nobody has a phone. So there's that bit when she's bored in the graveyard and she asks the Donald Sutherland character, do you have any gum? Because the only thing to pass the time is to do some chewing rather than, you know, go on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, she mentions she's got an answer machine, doesn't she, as well, in one
that's
scene.
That's right.
Wow.
Because
her boyfriend breaks up with her on the machine.
Oh, that's right.
She mentions. Yeah. God, we're old people.
It's depressing, isn't it? The ravages of time. Are catching up with us, gents. So, Dara, we always ask our guests as we get towards the end for their thoughts on the film, and also, should this film be staked through the heart or should this film live forever?
Oh, Lord.
A lot of pressure on that question.
Do you know what? I think it should live because I think it has got lessons to teach us. I think it's a curio, but it's not without interest.
And Dan?
Oh, I'm gonna say...
kill it dead.
Staked in the heart, I think.
Kill it a lot.
Staked through the heart, I think, Hugh. So you've got the deciding vote.
Yeah, I may have given the game away with my rampant booing and hissing of your decision there, Dan. But yeah, for me, it should live forever. It might just be my 90s nostalgia brain kicking in and really, you know, saving it from obscurity. But no, I agree with Dara. It's got lessons for aspiring screenwriters and people in the creative industries, but also it's an interesting historical piece for anyone who's a massive fan of the TV series. So yeah, I'm going to make sure this one lives forever.
Okay. If you decided with me, Hugh, all copies around the world would have just vanished overnight. We could have been done with it, but you've kept it alive.
We have that power.
Yes.
Can't wait till we get to the Underworld films. Maybe we can make them all disappear in one fell swoop.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
I'd like to thank guest Dara Carvel for coming along today. Dara, what are you up to right now? Where can our listeners find your work at the minute? What are you doing? What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm very busy at the moment. We're in the process of shooting series 4 of The Bay, which will be on ITV early next year. We're just coming to the end of block 1, which is episodes 1, 2 and 3, and then we'll move on to block 2. So yeah, a bit flat out at the moment.
Excellent. We'll look forward to that in the new year.
Any vampires in your future at all, Dara?
You never know.
We need more of that on British TV. Remember Ultraviolet was a favourite of mine? Need something like that back on.
Yeah, it's a funny thing because there's such a great tradition of fantasy, sci-fi on British television, and yet the perception in the industry is that it's a really, really hard sell. I'd love to do something. I mean, I would love to do something like Stranger Things, but here in the UK. So maybe I should.
Peculiar Things.
Yes, Peculiar Things.
Okay, so please follow us on Twitter at Vamp Videos for regular updates, information and teases about upcoming episodes. You can also follow us individually there at DanOwen79 and at AngrySkotsman81.
And if you want to leave a donation to support us, there's a link in the show notes to our Ko-fi page /vampire videos. Otherwise, simply subscribing and leaving a rating or review helps spread the word and increases our listenership, so we very much appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, and remember, Vampire Videos is part of the We Made This podcast network, so stay tuned for previews of more shows you may like to subscribe to in just a moment. We'll be back soon for more fiendish fun, but until next time, thanks for listening.
Hi folks, this is Tony Black, co-host and producer of Between the Notes, a podcast all about the music of film and television. Myself and co-host Sean Wilson delve into a range of topics including brand new film score releases.
So four notes can communicate the primal vengeance and rage of Robert Pattinson's, interpretation of...
yeah, I've heard that a couple of times.
Batman, yeah.
Focuses on specific composers such as Ennio Morricone.
Just to put this in context, Gwyneth Paltrow got an Oscar before Ennio Morricone did. I mean, how does that... how does that work?
And special episodes focusing on topics like adventure movie scores.
I think that principle is consistent all the way through Conan because it has to be, because it is an opera in which the music is the dialogue.
We're available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Between Notes Pod on Twitter and Facebook. So please subscribe, get in touch, and join us to discuss the sounds of cinema and television. Between the Notes.
Hello, and this is Chucky Vision on the We Made This Network, the podcast for all things Chucky. I'm Dev Elson.
And I'm Mark Adams. We're two queer podcasters who love bloody horror,
camp comedy, gay romance,
and referencing icons like Freddy, Jason, and Britney.
The Chucky films and new TV show deliver all of that, and there is still so much more to cover.
So if you wanna play, find Chucky Vision on Twitter at Chucky Vision and on all good podcast providers.
And yes, the title is a Chuckle Vision pun.
Because why not?